We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls. The Congress that will assemble in Washington next January will be very different from the one that is now in its final weeks. In the House, control will pass from the Democrats to the Republicans. In the Senate, Democrats will still have a majority, but it will be much more narrow than it is today. In this hour of Focus, we will review some of the big issues that are still on the table for the outgoing lame duck Congress and perhaps talk about the priorities of the soon-to-be majority in the House. And our guest for the program is Ben Pershing. He writes for the website WashingtonPost.com. He is author of the Capitol Briefing column there. It's a column that covers Congress. He's been working there now for a couple of years. Before going to work at WashingtonPost.com, he worked at Roll Call, the Capitol Hill newspaper, where he was the paper's deputy editor, overseeing all of the congressional coverage. And he worked for Roll Call for 10 years, spent a lot of time writing about activities there in Congress. He's been good enough to spend some time with us on the telephone to talk about contemporary Washington politics. And questions from people who are listening, of course, are welcome. We hope people will be on the topic and try to be as brief as possible. Then we just ask that so we can get in as many callers as possible. So here are the numbers. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So if you're local, use that one. Toll free, anywhere you're listening, 800-222-9455. You may also send us a message by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. And Ben Pershing, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. And how are you?
I'm doing quite well.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Sure.
Quite a big change coming here. We've got 16 new senators, something like 100 new House members, and the vast majority of them are Republicans. So this is a big turnover. And also what's notable about this is that several of those senators and even more of these new House members are people who have never held elected office before.
Right, right. That's true. That's true. It's quite a very large class of new members coming in and a pretty diverse background. You know, you don't necessarily have just your standard lawyers and, you know, state representatives. You've got people from all walks of life coming in.
How unusual is this kind of turnover?
It's very unusual. I mean, this is the sort of the largest loss of House seats that Democrats had in more than 60 years, since the 1940s. You know, you always have a certain amount of turnover, and particularly in midterm elections after a new president's been elected, there's some expectation of turnover. You know, you had that in 1994 with Clinton. You had that in 1982 with Reagan. 2002 with Bush was a little bit different because just after the September 11th attacks, he was unusually popular for a first-term president, and so he didn't, you know, he did better in the elections than normal. But
yeah.
This is fairly standard stuff. It's just the scale of it is unusual. The sheer number of seats Democrats lost, it's up to 61 right now, is very very large number.
Well, they just to talk about 94 for a little bit. I think that people maybe will want to draw parallels, or they might want to say, well, there actually are some significant differences. They'd say, you know, John Boehner and Newt Gingrich are two really different guys, and we've got two different presidents, and the conditions are different. How do you think this is or is not like 94?
It's certainly similar in some basic ways. You know, you obviously have a Democratic president. You have a Democratic president whom Republicans accused of being too liberal in his first 2 years, of overreaching, as it were. You know, you remember with Clinton, what he tried to do was health care reform with Hillary Clinton at the lead. And, it was unpopular. It was unsuccessful. It didn't work. But a lot of people saw that as a real deciding factor. There was also a vote back then, and then people may not remember this. There was a vote on basically a carbon tax back then in 1993 that a lot of Democrats didn't want to vote for, but they did. And when Democrats lost all these seats in 94, the two things a lot of them pointed at were, one, this sort of carbon tax vote, and two, the health care controversy. And so obviously there's some pretty direct parallels between then and now, because you have Democrats complaining once again about the things they had to vote on, and one of them was health care, and the other one was energy. So you have that basic similarity, you know, a Democratic president accused of being too liberal. On the other hand, as you said, you know, Gingrich and Boehner are very different. The majorities are different. The economy was weak then, but it wasn't nearly as weak as it is now. You know, you have the unemployment rate of over 9.5% is unusually high, historically high, going back for quite a while. And I think a lot of Democrats, frankly, will just blame that. They'll say, you know what, forget what we voted on, forget what the Obama administration's agenda was or wasn't. The unemployment rate is really high, and that makes people anxious about the economy. And so we were destined to lose regardless of what we did. That's how a lot of Democrats feel.
Just as before we go on to talk about issues, just as a point of trivia, and it, because it's something that you've written about, the term lame duck is actually pretty old, but it has interesting roots.
It does. It goes back. It started in Britain and in the 19th century, and it referred to bankers who'd lost all their money, essentially. You know, sort of as being weakened, weakened by injury, vulnerable. You know, literally like a, you know, an injured bird was the example I saw. And, you know, there's an obvious parallel between, you know, a banker who's lost all his money and a member of Congress who's lost his seat. You know, they're still here, but they have no power. They're vulnerable. They're weak. So the term lame duck refers to the members themselves who have lost, and then it also refers to the whole Congress that's sitting right now. They're sitting after Election Day. They've already sort of had judgment rendered on them by the voters, and they just have to serve out their term. Mm-hmm. So the lame duck sort of applies to both.
Yeah. Just let me quickly introduce again our guest, Ben Pershing. He writes for the website WashingtonPost.com. He's the author of the Capitol Briefing online column covering Congress. Also wrote for a number of years for Roll Call, the Capitol Hill newspaper, and he's a journalist who has been following Congress for some time now. We're talking a little bit about Washington politics. We'll talk here about some of the big issues that are on the table for the remaining weeks of this Congress and then perhaps look ahead to the next. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, in terms of things that are on the table right now, there are a couple of things that really are matters before the Senate, and we can talk about them. But maybe the big thing that everybody's involved in is the conversation about the tax cuts. They're known as the Bush-era tax cuts. They were passed in 2001 and 2003, and the reason that everybody's talking about them is that they are set to expire at the end of this year.
That's right, and you have some real divide between Democrats and Republicans over how to deal with them. Democrats are advocating extending the tax cuts for everyone who makes $250,000 or less and letting the tax cuts on wealthier people expire. Democrats argue, you know, that with the deficit so out of control, that the government needs this extra revenue, that, you know, rich people can certainly handle handle taxes that were as high as they were back during the Clinton administration. Republicans have kind of, you know, drawn a line in the sand and said, no, we got to extend them for everybody permanently. And so that's the fight right now is, you know, you could do three things. You could extend them just for the middle class, you know, people 250 and under.
Mm-hmm.
You could extend them for 250 and under and temporarily extend for wealthy people. Or you could extend all of them permanently for everyone. Those are sort of the different options on the table. Nobody wants to blink right now. Republicans obviously feel pretty empowered by the election results, and they say, look, we're not budging on this. It's not clear yet whether Democrats will budge.
Well, this the question is, I suppose, that if the Democrats decided they want to force this and they want to push the position that I think that the president has taken, where what he wants to do is extend the tax cuts for and this would cover almost everybody in the country. You know, we're talking about exempting the people who make the most money. So
Right. Anybody
who any household making under $250,000 a year, they get the cuts. The people above don't. So that's the position he's staked out.
Right.
Do the Democrats, if they wanted to, if they said we're going to the mat on this, we want this, do they actually have the power to do that?
It's not clear that they do. I mean, you have to remember the politics of the Senate. Right now, Democrats have 58 votes in the Senate. You need 60 to really get anything done. So, A, they'd have to attract a couple of Republicans over their side just to cut off debate over there. And then you have some moderate Democrats in the Senate who are wary of raising taxes on anybody who may not go along. So it's not clear that Democrats have the votes to really stay firm on this. That's why I think a lot of Democrats are hoping for the compromise, where they extend the top-end tax cuts, but only for, say, a year or 2 years, and then they can have the fight again in the future. Republicans are saying, no, let's extend all of them permanently. The issue there, the Democrats point out, is that, you know, that costs a lot of money. I mean, that's a lot of revenue not coming into government coffers, and that's fine, but then you have to, you know, Democrats say you have to offset that somehow. You know, they say, okay, well, are you going to cut spending somewhere else? And Republicans are not offering that. Republicans aren't offering anything to offset that loss of money. And so Democrats are saying, well, you know, you're hypocrites because you talk all about the deficit, but then here you want to extend these massive, expensive tax cuts. So that's where we are now.
So in terms of the if a deal could be worked out, a compromise, so that the tax cuts for the wealthiest people were just – so that extension is just temporary.
Yeah.
What sort of extension would we be talking about, and would that put us into the next presidential election?
Either 1 or 2 years are the examples that are most often cited. And then, yeah, you know, you would end up at the end of next year or 2 years from now having this fight again. What's interesting about that is that a year from now, obviously – Republicans will be in charge of the House, and they'll have a huge majority in the House. And so in theory, that gives them more leverage. On the other hand, I think Democrats know that it will still be incumbent on Republicans at that point to explain their math, and that, you know, if Republicans want to at that point have, you know, a $2 trillion tax increase or whatever the final number is without offsetting it, they're going to have to defend it. So, I mean, there's obviously a lot of political considerations on both sides going into this. If they wait a year, then this fight will happen in the middle, you know, will happen in 2011, which is a non-election year. And that may be, you know, easier for everybody to swallow.
Yeah. All right. Let's. We have a couple of callers. Let's talk with them first. To here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
The Surface Transportation Act was extended to the end of this year, and that has generally not been a partisan issue, but paying for the infrastructure. Is a difficult one, particularly when you have to expand the revenue source. The Deficit Commission has come out with a proposal for a 15-cent increase in the gas tax. What are the proposals for that, or just getting a Surface Transportation Act?
It's a good question. I'm not sure where that money is going to go. I mean, you know, that transportation bill, like you said, has generally been sort of a nonpartisan issue. It's popular on both sides of the aisle. All members of Congress like money for highways. But it is kind of caught in this interesting fiscal climate now where everybody's talking about deficit reduction. Everybody's talking about reducing spending. I think the days of sort of massive highway bills, massive infrastructure bills are maybe over for a little while. And I also don't think an increase in the gas tax is going to go anywhere for a while. You know, you have a big chunk of Republicans who just got elected vowing absolutely not to increase taxes on anything. And, you know, they may not be able to hold that pledge, but a 15-cent gas tax increase like the Deficit Commission proposes, I think it's pretty fair to say it's off the table for a while now.
Dave, thank you.
All right. On to Montgomery, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, you know what? Everybody seems to want to spend, but they don't want to cut the budget. I mean, I don't know. I'm willing to take a hit if they can do something about it. And this is a big problem. They're all talking about taxes, but did they take a pay cut themselves? No. Did they hold their own spending spree? No. They keep spending more money on military, you know, on defense spending. They keep spending more money on these roads that I know for a fact where I'm at, they've repaired the same road 3 times in the last 10 years. And the only reason they're doing that, to me in my eyes, is they're giving union jobs to these guys to get going. You know, it's hard for me to respect what the Congress and the Senate of the United States does because I, quite frankly, don't see a change. I'm just wondering what you think. Do you see in 2 more years or 4 more years, do you see any change whatsoever? You think it's going to go back to the Democrats in 2012? Because I actually see it flip-flopping back the other way because, like you said, the Republicans don't come up with any significant kind of, ideas. And it just seems like the American public I hear on this radio stations, TV stations, and other radio stations across the country have more ideas than those guys do. It doesn't make any sense. If we vote them in, I don't get it. Do you?
Well, a couple things I can say in response. You started off by mentioning Congress, you know, not cutting their own pay and not cutting their own spending. I think you are actually going to see a change there in the next year, because Congress actually hasn't taken a raise the last 2 years. They haven't cut their spending, but they haven't taken a raise for inflation either. And I think next year there's a very good chance they will cut their pay. I don't think it'll be a lot. They're still going to make a lot more money than most Americans. You know, they make over $170,000 a piece now. It's still going to be very high. But they likely will take some pay cut, and they also are going to cut their own budget. The amount of money Congress spends, Republicans have made very clear, they want to cut some of that. Even if it's only symbolic, they're aware of how people like you feel out there, and they want to do some cutting. Now, beyond that, whether Congress is going to flip back to Democrats in 2 years, I think 2 years is a little soon. I think it'd be difficult for Democrats to pull that off. I could see it, though, flipping back in maybe 4 years or six. I think sort of the era of the long majority may be over. You know, Republicans, I mean, Democrats were in charge for something like 50 years, and then Democrats were in charge for 14 years. And now, you know, it's going to flip. I think we're going to see shorter and shorter periods of time. So, yeah, it may well flip back in a few years.
Yeah, I think I was really struck by something. I believe it was E.J. Dionne said, and this, I think it was in the run-up to the election, when it looked like what was going to happen was, well, what happened. And he said that this was the third time in a row, the third election in a row, in which Americans have voted for change. And it seems that that kind of volatility, that unhappiness with government, leads people to say, you know, whoever is in charge, let's throw them out and put the other party in charge. But the feeling of dissatisfaction just seems to keep rolling along.
And the polls don't necessarily say, yes, we love all of Republicans' ideas. Yeah. Most polls actually find sort of both parties to be in very low esteem and find both parties' ideas to be in low esteem. So it's not as though voters said, yes, we love everything Republicans are saying, here you go. It's more like, we dislike both of you, and the Democrats are in charge, we're booting you out.
Well, and on the subject of spending cuts, now in the news here just recently, there has been some statements made by the men who lead the president's deficit reduction commission, and there are some other commissions like this. They're all looking at how the government spends money. And what seems to be really clear is that to make significant cuts in spending and in the deficit, you're going to have to do a lot of things, and something there on that list that is going to make everybody mad. You're going to have to cut entitlements. You're probably going to have to raise revenues. You're going to have to cut the defense spending. You're going to have to do all kinds of things for which there are important constituencies. And I think that people have looked at that, analysts have looked at that and said, you know, that's just not going to get any traction at all with the folks there on the Hill.
Right. You know, it's funny. You could almost compare what the Deficit Commission chairs released as sort of like a menu at a restaurant where every single dish sounds bad. but I think that was their point. You know, what they did was, I think the co-chairs of this, Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, they knew what they were releasing wasn't going to, you know, become law. What they wanted to do was essentially produce the whole menu of options. And yes, they're all unpopular. If they weren't unpopular, people would have probably done them by now. That's the point, you know. So you have things to anger everybody. You have defense cuts proposed and Homeland Security cuts that are going to anger, you know, a lot of Republicans. You have cuts in Social Security and Medicare and social spending that are going to anger Democrats. You have spending cuts across the board that liberals worry about. You have tax increases proposed, including like the gas tax increase and others that Republicans are going to dislike. And, you know, yes, every single one of these things is going to be unpopular with somebody. Some of them are going to be unpopular with everybody. But there literally is no way to balance the budget without doing some of these things or all of them. And I think that was the point they were trying to make. So, yeah, you know, of course people on the Hill didn't like it. That's how it's going to work. I mean, the only way there's going to be a deal is if each side takes a certain number of things they dislike and agrees to it. So,
on to another caller, Seattle, Washington. Line two. Hello.
There are a lot of contradictions in the political discussion today that bother me, but I just want to focus on one, and it's extending the tax cuts for the people at the top. And I don't understand. I have trouble understanding why there isn't more analysis of the theory behind that creating tax cuts for rich people actually, you know, creates jobs. I don't think there's much evidence for that, but you don't hear one way or the other on the media whether there is. And then there's another aspect where the party that wants the tax cuts for the top, they want to cut unemployment for the people who are actually unemployed and who need money the most, and yet they want to reward the people like at the top, who decide to send American jobs overseas or cut benefits, or like the bankers who did this mess to us. And there's this contradiction that I don't hear discussed or talked about, and I don't understand why this isn't glaringly obvious to anyone, but particularly the media. I just don't get it. Maybe you can explain that.
There is some economic analysis. You know, there probably should be more in the media. I have seen a fair number of stories that try to break this stuff down. You know, there's been a real dispute between the right and the left, going back to Reagan, over how to stimulate the economy. Remember, Reagan made the argument, it was called supply-side economics, and his argument was, if you cut taxes on people, the economic growth that stimulates will make up for it in government revenue. In other words, the economy will do so great that it will actually be better for the government and the government's revenues to cut taxes. Democrats back then said that was wrong, and the numbers didn't back it up. They say that again now. You have people all over the spectrum, people who say, well, it doesn't quite make up for the revenue, but it makes up for some of it. You have people in between. The general argument Republicans make now, there's a few of them. One is that tax cuts in general stimulate the economy. The more money people have, the more likely they are to spend it. The more money that entrepreneurs have, the more likely they are to invest it in new businesses. They also argue that if you raise taxes on people making over $250, a lot of those people are small business owners, and that you're hitting them and hurting them. You know, you hurt the economy, you put them back in a recession.
Well, you look at the kind of investments they made, and these investments are what destroyed our economy. They weren't creating jobs; they were creating garbage that destroyed.
Right. Well, on Wall Street, you certainly have that argument, and Democrats have made that point that, you know, bankers and people on Wall Street don't need any breaks. They certainly don't need any tax cuts. They don't need to do anything more than what they've been doing.
There's also this tendency to rake huge salaries, like billions, into their own pockets. If you take $1 billion and break it up, that is tens and tens of thousands of jobs, 100,000 jobs, decent jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, I just don't understand how a party can say that they want to create jobs for working people while cutting the benefits for people who just lost their jobs due to these policies, and at the same time want to reward the people who are pulling the strings on this. I just this what you're saying here isn't satisfactory. It doesn't explain it to me at all. And I guess you can't explain it. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
What about the extension of unemployment benefits? Isn't that something that they're going to have to deal with?
Yeah, it is, and they're trying to figure that out now. You know, they expire December 1st for certain people, and remember, these are people who have been getting them for many more weeks than sort of the standard program. I think some of them have been getting it for up to 99 weeks, which is, you know, an unusually large number of people. I mean, an unusually large length of time, but obviously we also have unusually high unemployment right now. So in previous times in the past year when Democrats have tried to extend that, they've had real fights. You know, I don't know if you remember Jim Bunning, the senator from Kentucky, filibustered this in March on the Senate floor, wouldn't give up the microphone. And his argument was that if you're going to extend these unemployment benefits, you need to pay for them. You need to offset it somehow, either with spending cuts elsewhere or something like that. Democrats wouldn't do it, and so they had a big fight. Yeah, they're about to have that fight again because Democrats do want to extend unemployment benefits, and Republicans at this point haven't said that they're willing to go along.
We're at the midpoint of this hour of Focus, and our guest for the show is Ben Pershing. He's a journalist who's been covering Congress for quite a few years. He now writes for the website WashingtonPost.com. He's the author of the Capitol Briefing column, the online column that covers Congress. Before going to work at the Post.com, he worked at Roll Call. That's the Capitol Hill paper. He was there for 10 years. He was that paper's deputy editor overseeing all congressional coverage. And we're trying to talk a little bit about some of the big issues that confront the Congress, both the lame duck Congress that has just a few more weeks here, and then perhaps we'll also talk a little bit about what people are looking ahead to for the next Congress. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. On to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Along with the gentleman from Washington, it seems to be that much of what is being said, and particularly by the media, is counterfactual. David, whom I greatly respect, recently said it would be necessary to cut entitlements. Cutting the taxes for the very wealthy And the very wealthy are getting a tax cut no matter what, because it's only the income beyond $250,000 they might suffer a heavier tax on. They get a tax cut with the rest of us on everything below that marginal point. But we have a set up here today where we have been increasingly concentrating wealth in the hands of the very, very wealthy. And many of the proposals, cutting entitlements, for example, Senator Domenici recently, in fact last night, suggested that we needed a general national sales tax of, I think it was 7%. All of these proposals seem to me to be simply transferring the burden of taxation from the very wealthy to the middle class, and with the sales tax in particular, it is putting it on the poorest.
I see your point, and you know what's interesting about the debate over entitlements, particularly Social Security, is that if you just cut benefits or raise the retirement age, then yeah, that actually does sort of disproportionately affect poorer people. But there are also proposals out there to sort of hit wealthier people harder by raising the amount of income that is taxed for Social Security. I mean, right now, I don't remember the exact number. I think it's up to $90,000-something in income is hit with Social Security taxes. And so if somebody makes $1 million a year, only the first, you know, 10% of what they make gets taxed for Social Security, and the rest of it is tax-free. And they're basically, you know, they're paying a smaller percentage of their income for Social Security than poorer people are. And one of the proposals to make Social Security more solvent is to essentially tax rich people more for it, or to index benefits depending on your income. So if you're wealthy, then you don't get as much Social Security back as poorer people do. Now, you know, all of these proposals are unpopular with some people and popular with others, but I just want to make the point, there are proposals to deal with entitlements that don't just affect poorer people. There are also proposals that would actually hit wealthier people harder.
I agree with you. I have heard. In fact, I backed the proposal to increase amount of income that can be taxed for Social Security and other social benefits. You don't hear very much about that.
Right. Well, you know, honestly, all of the proposals to tinker with Social Security are pretty unpopular with somebody. I mean, that's unpopular with some people. Raising the retirement age, you hear a lot about, that's unpopular with some people. You know, whether you raise the taxes or cut the benefits or change the retirement age, one of those things is going to have to be done, and all of them are unpopular with either everybody or a lot of people. So
I have just one further point, if I may. Before you can cut any of the benefits, you've got to find a way of increasing employment. I think that actually as the average life expectancy goes up, it makes very good sense to raise the point at which one begins to take Social Security.
Yeah.
And I might point out that being a university employee or ex-employee, I benefit no way from Social Security because I was denied that, even though I had paid into it before entering the university system.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you have alternative employment, raising the retirement age is ludicrous.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I need to jump in here. I got some other people I want to get in. I also would like to say for the record, I didn't really think that I was saying I thought entitlement should be cut, but was saying that, for example, the people who are heading up the president's Deficit Reduction Commission, they were saying that. I think that people who are in Washington who are looking at this whole question of spending are saying that. I'm not taking a personal position. Fortunately, no one has asked me what we should do to cut federal spending.
Perhaps they should.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Discuss the Build America Bonds program. Some say it might expire. And what are the chances for a bailout? Stateline.org says, D.C. says no bailouts. And yet, foreigners are buying up state buildings because the states need some money right away. Okay.
All right. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Build America Bonds program is something that Democrats like very much and included in a number of different stimulus bills in the last year. And it's sort of a program to help states and cities, local governments issue bonds. I don't know that that's going to get extended any further after this year. Again, it's just there's so many things to do in the lame duck, so little time and relatively little money. And there's definitely no appetite among Republicans to pass any more legislation that you would call stimulus. So even though Democrats really like the program and they argue that it has sort of a direct economic benefit, a stimulative benefit, it's hard to see anything along those lines passing, with you know, given what just happened in the election.
All right. Over to Belgium. Line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning, gentlemen. We started this conversation talking about throwing these bums out and put our bums in, and we've done this now. How many times? I can't even count the number of times we've done this over and over again. And it seems that the true problem is that we don't really have a middle ground that we can deal with. And unfortunately, the way that the Congress is set up, we never will have independent parties to produce a middle ground that we can all live within, because of the Electoral College and many things. And probably the most interesting aspect of your conversation so far, and that nobody has ever mentioned, is that the very first Congress that we had in the United States was made up of landowners who were wealthy. Today's Congress is made up with the majority of it, or if not the majority, a very strong percentage of them, are millionaires. The people like me are not really represented.
Well, I imagine the caller speaks for a lot of people. I don't know, Ben, what you can say about that.
It is true that the average member of Congress is rich. I mean, that's been like that for a long time. That doesn't mean there aren't some people in Congress who are different. You know, you do have sort of a wide variety of people. You know, even small business owners, you have people who might run like a pizza shop. There's at least one of those guys in Congress coming in. You have people who are, you know, come from relatively humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. But as a general rule, it's hard to make it to Congress if you're not, either professionally successful or just flat out wealthy. Either, you know, A, because it's an expensive thing to do, B, because it's hard to get to that point in your life where you can run for Congress without being successful somehow. You know, maybe you've been in politics your whole life. You know, you have some people who've been, say, in the state legislature or county officials going back years. Most of them aren't wealthy. They do pretty well, but they're not super wealthy. But as a general rule, most members of Congress are rich, particularly senators.
Okay. I want to thank the caller again. About 20 minutes left in this part of Focus with Ben Pershing from WashingtonPost.com. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to hit a couple of issues here that are things that are up in the Senate. One is something that truly is a hot-button issue that might be of interest to a lot of people, or at least they maybe know what it's all about. The other is something that's much more a policy matter that probably doesn't get as much attention. The first is don't ask, don't tell. The House has already approved the repeal. Harry Reid, who is the Senate Majority Leader, says he will push for a vote in the lame duck session. What do you think is going to happen?
I think it's probably going to fail. It's hard to say for sure. I mean, I think there are a fair number of Republicans who understand that this policy is going to end soon, but they want the Pentagon to be able to do it on its own time frame, and then whereas the most Democrats say that it's time now, it's been long enough, and let's push it. I don't think that Reid will have the votes to get it done now. Even among sympathetic Republicans, I think they're going to stick together and let it take its time. And what will happen here is it was attached to this defense authorization bill, which everybody in both parties wants to happen, and I think it's going to end up getting decoupled from that. Democrats will let the defense bill pass without it because they understand that it's important to get that bill passed. Don't ask, don't tell will get put off until the next Congress. I do think, though, that given everything that's happened recently, given the reports we've seen from the Pentagon, it's only a matter of time before the policy gets changed. It's just a question of whether it happens right now or, say, a year or two from now.
The other issue is the new strategic arms reduction treaty with Russia, something that President Obama has said he said, this is my foreign policy priority for the lame duck session. Now there's some, particularly because of comments by Senator John Kyle from Arizona, he's a Republican. He says, let's not rush on this thing. Maybe we should wait until next year. Some other Republicans, like Richard Lugar, have lined up behind it. What do you think is going to happen there?
I think it's going to get put off only because, you know, Kyle is the lead man on this issue for Republicans, and he's being pretty pessimistic. It's always possible this is a negotiating gambit, and then at the last minute, you know, maybe in December, that Republicans will concede. But, you know, there are two different issues here for Republicans. There are some Republicans, conservatives, hawkish Republicans on foreign policy, who just don't like this treaty period, who think that, you know, we shouldn't be negotiating this with the Soviet Union, with Russia, rather. The other wing of it is just a more practical level, is that they want to get something in return. And a lot of Republicans think that the U.S. needs to spend more money modernizing its nuclear missile fleet, modernizing its nuclear infrastructure, and they see this as an opportunity to get it. So the White House has already offered something like $4 or $5 billion extra to help pay for that. That's not enough for some Republicans, so they're holding out. So, you know, these are the different strands here. There's people who are just opposed to the treaty period, and there are people who say, well, we'll vote for the treaty, but only if we get X, Y, and Z in return. So at the moment, I don't see a path forward. It's always possible that if they keep at it, Republicans will get enough, and they'll give in and vote for it in December.
All right. Back to the phones. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I just wanted to clarify something that I think is not commonly known in the media and commonly represented or presented to the public, and that is that the leading academic economists are largely of the view that the stimulus has been far too small. If you take, for example, Joseph Stiglitz or Paul Krugman, who will often be sort of identified with the Democrats and so forth, well, no one notes that these are the leading economists in the world. If you look among economists' own rankings, out of 25,000 economists, they're number 2 and 14 respectively, and no one really listens to many of the people on the other side who claim that the stimulus is far too large. I just want to note that there is a political fight, but that among academics, Keynes has won. One thing to note is that with World War II, as Krugman noted, it took the equivalent of what would today be $30 trillion to get out of the Great Depression. And no one, of course, points to this fact that, you know, what we had as a supposedly large stimulus was extremely small given the size of our government. Stiglitz, Krugman, and others are pointing to the fact we're at the edge of deflation and a Japanese decade. And so this has been terribly ignored in the media, generally speaking. I think it was suggested by an earlier caller, but I think it's very, very clear this was the case. The other thing to note is that the Bull-Simpson report is a dramatically regressive answer to ways to cut the deficit. Recently, the Tax Policy Center has come up with a report saying that the bottom 80% of families would pay higher taxes than they did in the Clinton years, while the top 20% and especially the top 5% would pay less. Not exactly what you would call shared sacrifices, Krugman notes. And something to note here is that in real terms, there has been a gradual redistribution of wealth to the wealthy, of course, since roughly 1979, according to new research. And taxes, as you probably know, between 1938 and 1982 were between 75% and 94% at the top tax brackets. The very, very wealthy are suffering far less and also investing far less than those in lower brackets. And so the economists are clearly have taken views on this, but, of course, the politicians are not listening. And, of course, by extension, because the Chamber of Congress and so forth are receiving large amounts of money from health insurers and others, they're hearing only negative things about the efforts to deal with the deficit and so forth. So I just wanted to take note of that.
Very fine set of comments. Again, I don't know if, Ben, anything in particular you want to...
Just two quick points. I mean, I agree that it probably could be mentioned more that a lot of economists think the stimulus should have been larger, and this actually came up quite a bit when the stimulus was being crafted, but it's also worth remembering the stimulus barely passed. It didn't get any Republican votes, and it barely got enough Democratic votes. So, you know, whatever the economic argument, there was no political will back then to do a larger stimulus. And the other issue that I think is interesting is that a lot of the economists you mentioned, like Krugman and Stiglitz, don't see the debt and deficit at their current levels as particularly problematic. Maybe in the long term, in the short term, they don't think there's something that needs to be addressed particularly quickly, whereas I think in poll after poll, the public thinks they do need to be addressed. Now, it could be an issue where the public doesn't know as much about economics as Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz do. You know, you can see lots of arguments back and forth on that issue. But the disconnect there, it's not just about a matter of the media sort of ignoring these people. It's more that the public right now is in a point where we very much wants the deficit to be addressed. And that contradicts what a lot of economists think.
All right. Another caller here, Lake Forest, Illinois, I believe. Line number four. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question. In this conversation, as always, there's many terms of political will. Do you think that if there was term limits that were imposed, particularly on the House of Representatives, that people would make the correct decision versus the political decision? And when they're elected, they're working on their reelection immediately. So I feel, and this might be incorrect, that these congressmen are doing what's in the best interest of the reelection versus the best interest of the country.
A couple of thoughts on that. One is that term limits, unless it was literally limited to 1 2-year term, most members of Congress would still be worrying about their reelections. You know, like let's say it was three terms, 6 years. You know, 2/3 of members would still be up for reelection and they'd still be worrying about their reelection. So, you know, that's one issue. The other argument that people make is that worrying about your reelection is code for trying to figure out what it is your constituents want you to do. And, you know, there's a school of thought that members of Congress should do what they think is right and stand up even for things that are unpopular. And sometimes that's a good thing to do. But on the other hand, there's certainly a case to be made that it's not a bad thing when members of Congress try to figure out what it is their constituents want and then do that. And the other issue is nobody knows what kind of Congress we would have if there were real term limits. What kind of people would run? What would they do with themselves afterwards? You could see a case where members of Congress are worried about what they're going to do in 6 years. And so maybe they're going to vote in a way that helps them get a job, and that certainly wouldn't be helpful in your mind. You know, maybe they want to be lobbyists. Maybe they want to go work for big companies. Maybe that affects their voting record even more than sort of the current worries about reelection do. So I can't possibly prove one way or the other because we've never seen that kind of world.
All right. I thank the caller again. We'll go to line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Getting back to that raising the age of getting Social Security, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And I was just reading that apparently the life expectancy for a 65-year-old male at the top half of the income has actually increased by 6 years over the past 3 decades. However, the bottom half is just barely increased more than a year. And as Paul Krugman says, it's like telling janitors they can't retire because lawyers are living longer. So just the fact that the people use this statistics can be real misleading. And I have a real problem with that. And I understand that the regressive recommendations of the committee are along those lines. The people who can least afford it have to pay. And somewhere I read recently that extending unemployment, you would actually get back $1.60 for every dollar you paid out. I'm not sure how that works, but they were talking about that people who are in unemployment will spend all that money, and somebody will, you know, business will get it. So it's not like you're just throwing it out the window and nothing's going to happen. So anyway, thank you very much.
All right. Well, again, any comment you want to make on that?
Just one quick thing is I read the Krugman column you mentioned, and it is true that, you know, it's easy for white-collar people to say, oh, you should retire later, whereas people in blue-collar jobs or maybe doing manual labor, it's a little harder to keep at it when you're older. But even citing the statistics that he just cited, the life expectancy for everybody now is still higher than it was when Social Security was created back in the 40s, you know, even for poorer people. You know, back then it was like, okay, you retire at 65, you're probably only going to live 10 years. I mean, that was just the average, or even less than 10 years. The idea that people were living well into their 80s is a normal, or even into their 90s, when they created Social Security, it never occurred to them that people would live that long. And so they'd be taking out benefits a lot longer than they did back then.
All right. We are coming down to about 5 minutes left. Again, we're talking this morning with Ben Pershing. He writes about Congress for WashingtonPost.com. We'll try to get some other callers. One question I do want to ask, just looking ahead to the next session of Congress, there are many Republicans who have been saying for some time now that it's their intention to try to repeal the health care reform that was passed by Congress. Just recently, John, I'm sure I've heard John Boehner say that. Do you think that that's just is that just rhetoric on their part? Is that just the kind of thing that, that they're saying because their constituents like the sound of that? Or is that something, do you think, that they're actually serious about?
Well, 2 points. One is it's not going to happen in the next 2 years. It can't, because Democrats still control the Senate, and obviously Obama has the White House, and he's never going to go along with that. Now, if the question is, will the House take a vote on something that says repeal the health care bill, there's a good chance that they will. And it will be a symbolic vote, because everybody voting on it on both sides is going to know it's not actually happening. What could happen more realistically is that Republicans try to get rid of parts of it or defund it, as in, say, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services can't spend any money implementing this law. And those, you know, those are the votes that will get more interesting, that have a slightly more of a chance to pass. Again, you still have Senate Democrats in the way. You still have Obama in the way. But Republicans may start trying to attach to popular bills provisions saying, let's cut this unpopular thing, let's cut that unpopular thing. You know, the individual mandate that requires everybody to buy insurance. Mm-hmm. Republicans may think, well, that's unpopular, let's just get rid of that. Now, if you get rid of that, the whole bill falls apart, but that's not really their concern. Their concern is, can they weaken the bill any way they can? And I think you will see votes next year and the year after on things like that.
All right. To Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm returning to the tax fairness issue, and now we've had the second commission or some sort of group, the Riblin-DeConcini group, and they're only marginally less regressive. They include a value-added tax, which is value-added tax, which can be argued for, but it is sort of a consumption tax, depending on how it's implemented. It can be there can be a rebate for lower-income people, but it's what I wanted to bring up, and it's certainly not on the docket in the lame duck session. It's not been talked about much, though it is a tax that's being used in other countries, and that's a transaction tax. It has been offered by Krugman and others, but I hope he returns to the subject, because it's sort of the elephant in the room. It has the added benefit of trying to slow down this casino economy where Goldman Sachs has the high-speed switches near the stock exchange, so they can marginally be faster on a call of some kind, and it's a crazy thing that can be regarded as a competitive advantage and a way to make money, and a transaction tax is clearly not on the agenda with Erskine Bowles, who is a corporatist, and most of these other people are too. But anyway, I'll let that hang in the air, and I appreciate the opportunity at least to raise it as a subject for future discussion, perhaps.
All right. Well, again, any comment you want to make?
I'll let that one go. I'm not a tax policy expert. So.
All right. Go to Urbana then. Line number 1. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just have a question about you just had a brief discussion about term limits and talked about constituencies. And when politicians talk about the fact that the American public has now spoken and have given rise to the Republican Party and have empowered them. However, a fairly large percentage of the American people voted for someone who didn't get into office. So how do you square all of those? And maybe the rhetoric just needs to change a little bit, because the American people who voted did not speak in one voice.
I think, you know, that's an interesting point, and I actually just saw some stats that I believe are correct, so I'll cite them from yesterday, was that in 2008, across the board, I believe 53% of Americans voted for a Democrat for the House, for Congress, and 47% of Americans voted for a Republican. And in this election that just happened, the numbers were roughly reversed, 53-47 the other way. Now, it's not exactly that, but it's close to that. And so it's funny, because in both cases, in 2008, Democrats said, you know, aha, we're empowered. This is an overwhelming mandate for us. And now a lot of Republicans are saying the same thing. And I think in both cases, you can argue it's really only something like 6 or 7% of people who are flipping.
Yeah.
And you know, even in the biggest landslide election like this, almost half of people voted for a Democrat. And, you know, you don't necessarily see that reflected in policies in Washington.
And I think also when I hear people talking about mandates and the American people speaking, I also think about the fact that there are significant numbers of Americans who don't vote at all.
Yes. Especially in a midterm.
We have maybe about a minute or so. I just do want to ask real quickly, with the people in the House there have taken their votes for the leaders. John Boehner is going to be the speaker, Republican from Ohio. No big surprise there.
Right.
Were there people surprised that Nancy Pelosi managed to hold on to her position as leader of the Democrats in the House?
No one was surprised that she held on once she decided to run. There were a significant number of people who thought that she wouldn't run. You know, just as sort of a matter of course, when your party loses as many seats as they did, you step down. That's what a lot of people think. Once she decided to run, it was pretty clear there was no obvious competitor who was going to beat her. If there had been one, like a real legitimate person, she might have lost yesterday, but nobody stepped forward to do it. So, you know, once we had the ballot, it was her versus Heath Shuler from North Carolina, it was clear she was going to win. You know, whether that's a good idea for the party is another debate.
Hmm. I mentioned in the beginning that there's going to be a big change here. We have 16 new senators and something like 100 new House members. And in the House, more than 80 of those are Republicans.
Right.
Not only do we have new people coming in, but we're having some people who really campaigned on the idea that says, if you send me to Washington, I'm going to go there and I'm going to shake things up and I'm going to change the way things are done. And we're, you know, that sort of stuff, and you wonder, well, what exactly does that mean if we have a lot of people who come to Washington with the stated intention of challenging the way business is done?
It's a good question. You know, there's definitely going to be a moratorium on earmarks and spending bills, and I think that's the influence of these new members coming in. I think the existing members see the writing on the wall and say, okay, we've got to change the way we do business. There's going to be cuts in earmarks. As I mentioned earlier, there's probably going to be a cut in congressional pay. There will definitely be a cut in the congressional budget and how it does business. And then beyond that, I think you're going to see some real serious spending cuts in the next year, or at least proposals for spending cuts, the likes of which we haven't seen in a very long time. And I think that's going to be a reflection of all these new freshmen coming in, throwing their weight around.
Well, there we're going to have to stop our guest, Ben Pershing. He writes for the website WashingtonPost.com. He's the author of the Capitol Briefing column that covers Congress. He's been covering Congress for some time. Before that, he worked for 10 years for Roll Call, the Capitol Hill paper covering Congress there. And Mr. Pershing, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.